This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's been nearly 4 years since the spectacular collapse of Enron focused national outrage on corporate scandals. Since then, the government has prosecuted a string of high-profile corporate executives, but convicting them? That's been another story. Take the case of Dennis Kozlowski, the former head of Tyco. He was accused of siphoning off millions to buy yachts and fine art. His Fifth Avenue apartment in New York City was furnished with a $6,000 shower curtain and a $15,000 poodle-shaped umbrella stand. You might think such indulgence would translate into a slam dunk in court, but the Kozlowski case ended in a mistrial. Last week, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction of Enron's accountants, Arthur Anderson, and it looks as if another mistrial may be looming in Birmingham, Alabama, where a federal jury has been unable to reach a verdict after 12 days of deliberation on the case against former HealthSouth Corporation chief executive Richard Scrushy. Now, there have been conviction and plea bargains as well, but in many cases, the legal outcome does not seem to match the public anger. Do these alleged criminals have better lawyers, or does the nature of white-collar crime make them hard to convict? Later in the program, Bob Geldof joins us to talk about the music spectacular he vowed never to do. 20 years after Live Aid, Geldof mounts a new effort for Africa called Live 8. But first, white-collar convictions. If you've ever been involved in a white-collar crime trial as defendant, witness, victim, or juror, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Samuel Buell joins us now. He's a law professor at the University of Texas, also a former federal prosecutor who took on the Arthur Anderson case. He joins us from the production room at the University of Texas School of Law in Austin, Texas. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil. It's great to be here.
Let me ask you first about the issue of criminal intent and why that's proved to be central in the Anderson case and others.
Well, Neil, I think the reason is really that in many criminal cases, particularly involving street crimes, violent crime, drug distribution, that kind of thing, it's very easy in most cases to conclude criminal intent just from the conduct. Simply by observing what the defendant did and satisfying oneself that it was done knowingly and intentionally, as the law says, is enough to satisfy one that there was criminal intent. In a white-collar case, on the other hand, very often the conduct itself is difficult to conclude a great deal from. The conduct may be conduct that is part of ordinary market behavior. Publishing a company's financial statement or making representations to investment analysts on Wall Street about a company's stock is ordinary, everyday behavior in corporate America. And what has to be determined in these cases is, was a fraud committed, usually, in the course of that conduct? And that's going to turn on whether not only whether something was said that was false, but did the person who said it know it was false? So you've got to really get into another person's state of mind, and that's a very difficult matter to prove, particularly under the rules that apply in our legal system, and especially our criminal legal system.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the Anderson case, if recollection serves, somebody sent out a memo, an email, I think like 2 weeks before Enron really had problems, reminding everybody of the company policy of, hey, eliminate any unnecessary paperwork, and a shredding party ensued. Anderson was indicted. The corporation itself was indicted. That's pretty controversial, too. But then the conviction was overturned when the Supreme Court said that the judges in his instructions to the jury did not emphasize, at least not strongly enough, that the prosecution had to prove that Anderson knew what it was doing was wrong.
Well, this is an interesting issue because it really raises the question of whether it's not just harder to prove intent in a white-collar case as compared to, for example, a street crime case, but whether, in fact, the intent itself is something different in a white-collar case. And so in Anderson, it was widely understood, certainly by the government and most participants in the system, including this judge, at the time of the trial, that the law required the government to prove that the documents were destroyed with an intent to keep them away from the SEC. That looks something much more like traditional criminal intent. In other words, that the Anderson folks did what they did, knowing what they were doing, knowing that the purpose was to make those documents unavailable in the SEC investigation. Well, the Supreme Court ruled that under its reading of this particular federal statute, something more was required. In fact, what the government had to prove was not only that Anderson intended to keep the documents away from the SEC, but that it, in the words of the Supreme Court, had consciousness of wrongdoing at the time that it did that. In other words, that Anderson's people knew there was something dishonest or bad about destroying documents to keep them away from regulators. And that's a particular kind of intent, a sort of heightened intent, which does tend to be kind of unique to white-collar crime.
Yeah. And among those most interested in reading that Supreme Court ruling were lawyers for Frank Quattrone, the Credit Suisse First Boston banker. He has also been convicted, but is appealing in part, I think, on the grounds of that Supreme Court ruling.
Well, I haven't looked at Mr. Quattrone's appeal, but I imagine that he will be relying on that ruling. And it's going to be interesting because what Mr. Quattrone will be doing is trying to get that ruling extended even beyond the statute that was used in the Anderson case, because Mr. Quattrone was prosecuted not only under the statute used in the Anderson case, but under some additional statutes that were not available for reasons having to do with the stage at which the SEC proceeding was in Anderson were not available in the Anderson case. So Mr. Quattrone will be trying to extend the idea that the government has to prove this heightened consciousness of wrongdoing into a whole number of the federal obstruction of justice statutes. So his case may turn out to be kind of a test of how far this idea the Supreme Court has about special intent is going to go.
Now, one of the problems with indicting CEOs is that they're often not participating in the email exchanges and going to all the meetings that everybody else goes to. One thing that was supposed to put a new emphasis on chief executives was the Sarbanes-Oxley law passed by Congress in the wake of Enron, which said CEOs now have to sign off on financial statements. But even that is looking a little shaky, as we see in the jury that maybe a mistrial is looming in Birmingham.
Well, I'm not sure how much that rule really changes things as a practical matter. I think it may have some more general influence in that the requirement that CEOs sign these statements may have a kind of bracing effect on a person and making them really think hard about what's in them. But in most cases, including the Enron case, executives even before Sarbanes-Oxley were more or less responsible for what their company's financial statements said. They usually got up in front of Wall Street every quarter and said, these are good numbers. And so the issue, I think, even with the signing requirements still is needing to prove that the person knew that there was something false about that statement when it went out. And simply having signed it is not enough to prove in a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt that there was fraudulent intent.
We're talking about corporate crime. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Roger joins us now on the line from San Antonio, Texas.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I guess, how do you prove then this conscious, the fact that these people were that was their intent to do. I mean, the fact that they were shooting documents before the fact to avoid the review, that seems enough to me for the connection of intent. To go above that seems a little ridiculous. It's like saying, well, what were you thinking at the time? And anybody can lie that. I mean, it doesn't take it, that's what I'm trying to figure out is how do you get above the Supreme Court ruling then?
Yeah, Samuel Buell, as I'm sure you argued to the jury, awfully suspicious to start shredding documents just in advance of the collapse.
Well, keep in mind that the Supreme Court didn't say in the Arthur Anderson decision that the evidence in the Anderson case wasn't sufficient to meet that standard. It simply said that the jury should have received an instruction talking about something having to do with consciousness of wrongdoing. I don't want to comment on whether that's going to be able to be proven if there's a retrial in Anderson, because the case is now back in the lower courts and it's at a sensitive stage. The government's deciding presumably what to do, and I don't want to get into that. But often in these white-collar cases, what folks and courts reviewing them afterwards tend to look at and evaluating them is something that practitioners often refer to as the badges of fraud. And that is whether the individual engaged often in some kind of cover-up or concealing activity which can include things like shredding documents, but also altering documents, falsifying records, lying about the conduct after the fact, and so on, that tends to show that the person knew at the time they were engaged in whatever the business conduct is that's under inspection, knew that it was wrong, and they didn't want other people to be able to see the truth about what they were doing.
Roger?
Yeah, but I would say, but wouldn't consciousness of wrongdoing, I mean, knowing that, that, I mean, some people, like, you know, you have mass murderers or whatever who are committing crimes who have no awareness that what they're doing is wrong. I mean, you know, so how would you prove to somebody who's doing this habitually, like in Enron or whatever, where, you know, thousands of people were going to, you know, lose their retirement and these people weren't even thinking that that was wrong? You know, so how would you, I mean, how does that make them any more culpable, I guess?
Right. I mean, I think the caller raises an excellent point that's raised by the Supreme Court's decision in Anderson, which is, what do we really mean by this idea of consciousness of wrongdoing? And how serious are we about the idea that in white-collar crime, the intent really ought to be something different and more heightened than it is in other cases? I think the reason why we're seeing this in court decisions like Anderson is that courts worry about creating a criminal law that may overly intrude into what's viewed as ordinary market behavior. And they're worried that standards may shift, that at a certain time when markets are going well, a particular kind of conduct might be viewed by an industry or even society at large as socially acceptable, and only after the fact, when there's a market crash or something, people are going to turn around and say, well, you should have known that what you were doing was wrong. And that seems to kind of go against a fundamental principle of the criminal law, which is that everybody has a right to have notice, to know in advance what the law is going to prohibit and what it isn't. And white-collar crime, unlike violent crime, involves a kind of shifting line of what's socially acceptable that sometimes moves over time, and courts worry about the effect of that.
Roger, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Samuel Buell, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, Neil.
Samuel Buell, former federal prosecutor in the Arthur Anderson case, now a law professor at the University of Texas. We'll talk about corporate crime from the defense attorney's point of view when we come back from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about corporate crime and why it can be hard to win convictions against CEOs in the courtroom. If you've ever been involved in a trial that dealt with white-collar crime, we would like to hear your story. 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email, totn@npr.org. Jacob Frankel joins us now, a defense attorney who specializes in white-collar crime and SEC matters at Shulman, Rogers, Gandel, Porty, and Ecker. He's with us now from his office in Rockville, Maryland. Thanks very much for being with us on the program.
Neil, you're welcome. Thank you.
And why don't we pick up where we left off talking just a few minutes ago with Samuel Buell and this question of the difficulty of establishing criminal intent.
It is difficult to establish criminal intent, but what we've seen in a lot of these cases is because of the difficulty that prosecutors have in meeting that burden, where they have made the mistake is trying to water down the criminal intent element in the jury instruction. So while they may win the case to the jury and get the verdict, you end up with an Arthur Anderson scenario, which is ultimately the Supreme Court saying you didn't give the right instruction. The fact is, you know, our judicial system recognizes a difference in the standard of proof in criminal cases and civil cases. There's a much lower burden, for example, that the SEC must meet, which is true in any civil case, preponderance of the evidence, 50% plus one. But it's well established in a criminal case, prosecutors must prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense does not have to do anything. The burden is entirely on the government. And, you know, I was listening to the discussion with Mr. Buell, and I don't think, you know, this notion of white-collar crime sort of shifting with social policy or social sentiment really is the case. These are laws that are on the books. It's the Department of Justice that only post-Enron, post-WorldCom, post-AOL, and all the other cases that really represented the weaknesses in conduct in corporate boardrooms in the late 90s when the market was in its boom stage, that the Department of Justice really first stepped in very aggressively, doing what jurisdictions such as the Southern District of New York has done for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The burdens of proof have not shifted. It's the government's obligation to meet that burden. And I think what we're seeing, unlike in the past, in addition to the fact that many more cases are being brought, is that you're now seeing senior executives of major corporations actually mounting a defense in these cases. They're able to afford counsel, are doing so. They're not rolling over. And all of a sudden, what historically have been pleas or part of the process to climb the ladder to make the high-level prosecutions, you're finally getting to that defendant who is pushing back, and all of a sudden the government is finding that they don't control all the cards.
And, well, one of the things, of course, they do fight back, and they can afford very good lawyers like yourself. And these are, I've heard it, these are subtle cases. This is not, armed robbery.
It's more than just subtle cases. When you're talking about somebody pointing a gun, it's clear. When you talk about the WorldCom case with Bernie Ebbers, which is a far more difficult case than the Scrushy case,
mm-hmm.
there was no what's often referred to as the smoking gun. I mean, the issue is when you're talking about corporate conduct, when people are falsifying records, actually participating in that falsification of records in the discussions, and participants are saying so-and-so directed this activity, that's clear evidence of criminal intent. But, I mean, you were talking about Quattrone before, and I think Roger's question, went to one of these issues as well in terms of proving conscious intent. You go to the Supreme Court opinion, the actual words of the Supreme Court opinion in Anderson, where, for example, because we're talking about conduct in the corporate boardroom, the words of the opinion along the lines were document retention policies, which is really what the court was saying the company was following, are created and serve a legitimate business purpose, and that it's not wrongful for a manager to tell employees that it's okay to comply with a valid document retention policy. Those are the kind of nuances in the corporate world that often can make that subtle difference between criminal intent and lack of criminal intent. And I think, Mr. Buell, to go on about this, raised was the issue of sufficiency of evidence. He's right, but we have to remember, in the criminal cases, the burden is very high.
I think we understand that, but another issue is that, one part of the judge's instructions to the jury may have been, obviously were incorrect, at least according to the Supreme Court, but this is a phone book of instructions the jury received from this judge.
Well, that's true in all criminal cases. You would think that in a simple drug case, let's say importing 50 kilos of cocaine, that the instruction would be it's against the law, to import the cocaine. And by the way, the government has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, and have to show that the person intended to import the cocaine. Even in a case such as that, which seems that simple, where it's more of a crime against the person, as people would often look at an armed robbery or an importation mm-hmm. of a controlled substances case. Fact is, jury charges are difficult, they're voluminous, and the government needs to try its case to what the correct jury instructions are going to be, not to what they want it to be, because that's how the government is, in essence, watering down the criminal intent standard.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Scott. Scott's calling from San Francisco.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was a Wall Street whistleblower about 10 years ago, and I'd like to ask a question concerning the issue of plausible deniability, because these cases and mistrials in the Sarbanes-Oxley and even the way our government works now with distancing themselves through different layers of contractors, they're creating all these people, and executives are having a greater incentive to establish plausible deniability. So the different layers are making it harder to prove these cases, and the fact that we're going to require CEOs to sign on the bottom line, I don't think is going to have a market effect. It's just going to make that person more intent on being careful about, you know, covering themselves in the future.
Let's for an answer, let's turn to Pamela Busey, a professor of law at the University of Alabama School of Law, the author of White Collar Practice. She's with us from the Alabama Public Radio Studios in Tuscaloosa. Nice of you to join us today.
My pleasure.
What about plausible deniability?
I think the caller is exactly right. That is certainly one of the challenges in prosecuting any complex white-collar case. You have multiple individuals involved. You usually have a large organization. And to pierce that organization and figure out who really knows what's going on is very difficult. And there may not be one person who knows what's going on.
But isn't one person supposed to know what's going on, the CEO?
Of course. But whether they are criminally liable for failing to know what's going on is a different issue.
Let me ask you, Jacob Brinkel, in the Scrooge case, the Health South case, I think 17 of the lesser lights have pleaded guilty in the case. But it now looks as if there could be a mistrial in Mr. Scrooge's trial.
I think we have to look at the reason for that possible mistrial. I mean, there was also a mistrial in the first Kozlowski case,
right,
involving Tyco, which is one juror held up the case. I think one of the misperceptions or misconceptions is that, I mean, we think in absolutes based on the late, you know, based on the evening television shows, there's either going to be a guilty or a not guilty. You know, if a corporate defendant who's facing many years is actually brought to trial, the defense considers it a win for there to be a result other than a conviction, because as long as the client is not convicted, he still remains free. So what we saw in Kozlowski, what's probably going on in Scrooge, because I don't think anybody would debate the notion that the evidence in the Health South case against Richard Scrooge is far more compelling than the evidence in the WorldCom case against Bernie Ebbers. But the defense was successful in playing to one or multiple jurors that has caused the jury to be unable to reach a verdict. And for the defense, that too is considered a victory to be able to go on to another day.
All right. Scott, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Tamer. Tamer's calling from Silver Spring in Maryland.
Yes.
Hi.
My question is, why do we have this term, white-collar crime? Crime, crime. Why do we differentiate?
Well, Pamela Busey?
Again, that's a great question, and there should not be a differentiation. To convict someone, to charge someone with a crime, and then to convict them is a very serious matter. And it should be seen as a crime. It should be proven as a crime. White collar was defined in the 1930s by a sociologist to refer to people who abuse their position of trust. But it's clearly a misnomer to refer to it as white collar. I think to look at it more as people who are in a position of trust and abuse that trust, generally with financial issues, is a more accurate way of looking at it. But it's not any different than street crime, and it should not be treated any differently because the result is just as serious for all the parties involved.
And in fact, if I can just add, as Professor Busey indicated, when you start talking about positions of trust, now that Congress, through the Sentencing Commission, has legislated sentencing standards, sentencing guidelines, there is an actual enhancement. In other words, the potential for a longer, greater sentence when somebody does, in fact, abuse a position of trust.
Thanks for the call, Tamer.
Thank you.
Professor Busey, let me ask you, in presenting these kinds of cases to the jury, it's a lot of numbers. It's very complicated. Do eyes glaze over?
Yes, they do. I think the rule that a prosecutor has to keep in mind if it's a criminal case, or the plaintiff if it's a complex civil case, is if you bore the jury, you lose. To figure out what's going on is complicated. To figure out which documents, to, as the attorney who's presenting the case, to figure out which witnesses can take the stand and present the information is just part of the challenge. I would say that's just 20-30% of the game of presenting any kind of complex financial case to a jury. The rest of it is figuring out how in the world are you going to present it so that they understand it and so that they find it interesting.
We are talking.
If they're bored, they will not be able to convict.
We're talking with Pamela Busey, professor of law at the University of Alabama Law School, and with Jacob Frankel, a former prosecutor and SEC enforcement lawyer, now a defense attorney specializing in white-collar crime. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Tony. Tony's with us from St. Louis.
G'day. I saw yesterday that the Securities and Exchange Commission budget is going to be cut. And so does that mean that the SEC is going to be rendered back to low man on the totem pole?
Are they filing the teeth of the SEC, Pamela Busey?
Somewhat. I think when you start looking at budget cuts, you have to wonder what the priorities are. Maybe the budget's going to be shifted around to different enforcement areas, but I think that's a cause for concern.
Thank you.
Tony, thanks very much for the phone call. Let me follow up with you. We asked earlier to Jacob Frankel about the Sarbanes-Oxley law, and that's, of course, the law, I think, under which Richard Scrushy is being tried right now. Is it having the desired effect, do you think, Professor?
I think it's too early to tell. It is certainly having some effects. One of the effects is that it's costing companies an awful lot of money to attempt to comply with it. A second effect is that it has scared CEOs and CFOs into being a whole lot more careful than they were. Will it stop corporate fraud? No. Nothing will stop corporate fraud. People are ingenious. They will always figure out other ways to lie and cheat.
Given the fact that people will always lie and cheat, human nature being what it is and temptation being what it is, but given the difficulty of these of obtaining convictions, would the government be wiser to pursue more of these cases in civil court, do you think?
I think that's certainly a policy issue that the Department of Justice should consider. The resources that it takes to successfully prosecute a criminal white-collar case are mammoth. In terms of just the preparation, the attorney time, I mean, we could go on and on. The Department of Justice, as the gatekeeper to those resources, I think has a fiduciary duty to use those resources wisely and should not embark upon cases that are such a close call that it's not clear that there will be a criminal conviction. Sure. So, yes, I think you're right that civil prosecution should be considered as a very strong alternative in most of these cases.
Jacob Frankel, let me put that same question to you. And along the way, if you could give us some idea of the resources available to a high-profile client.
Well, I mean, I think the resources available to a high-profile client simply really are as deep as that pocket will permit and as long as they're willing to fight. I think Professor Busey is right about discretion, but I think we have to look at really what happened, and this ties also back into her answer about the SEC. I don't believe the budget cuts are really going to make a big difference at the SEC, particularly in enforcement, because the enforcement division has virtually doubled in size in the last 5 years, has brought many more cases, and all agencies make allocation of resources decisions in terms of the cases that they're going to bring. You know, as the cases, as there are more and more cases of larger size, of greater consequence to more prominent individuals. I mean, we can talk about, you know, what's happening in AIG, the case against Hank Greenberg right now, who has since been charged civilly by Attorney General Spitzer, but now we saw the first criminal plea or the announcement of the criminal information being filed. I think the plea is tomorrow, involving a senior executive of Gen Ray. I mean, is that something that's going to remain civil against Hank Greenberg? Is it going to become criminal? This is somebody who no question, for reputational reasons, if nothing else, is going to fight to the end. Ultimately, the obligation is on the government. It doesn't matter whether it's the Department of Justice, the SEC, or any other agency, or even a state or self-regulatory agency, to exercise proper prosecutorial discretion to bring cases that serve a policy objective and will serve a deterrent effect. That's why you're seeing so many criminal prosecutions, because what was going on in the 90s, whatever level of enforcement was, by whomever, did not serve that deterrent purpose. And I think the big question, we talk about the next chairman of the SEC, Christopher Cox, will be how, if at all, he's going to try to push that pendulum from overcorrection back to the middle, whatever that new middle ground is going to be.
We have a couple of more questions. Can you guys stay with us over the break, a couple of more minutes?
Certainly.
Sure.
Great. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about CEOs, white-collar crime, and the difficulties of obtaining convictions, as we've seen in a couple of cases. Join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're talking today about white-collar crime, the difficulty of convicting, particularly CEOs. Our guests are Jacob Frankel, a former prosecutor and SEC enforcement lawyer, now a defense attorney specializing in white-collar crime and SEC matters at Shulman, Rogers, Gandahl, Porty, and Ecker. He's with us from Rockville, Maryland, and with Pamela Busey, a professor of law at the University of Alabama Law School and the author of White Collar Practice, as she's with us at Alabama Public Radio Studios in Tuscaloosa. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, or you can email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Let's go to a phone call. Julie is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, we were victims of an embezzlement from a corporate officer. We have a small corporation that's about $2 million a year. And when we discovered it, we took it to the district attorney trying to prosecute her, and they just pretty much turned it down. As you were commenting, you know, it was like, well, we don't have the resources right now to pursue this. So we then proceeded with a civil case, and the person filed bankruptcy.
So you ended up...
Even in small situations, it seems like these are very difficult to pursue.
Jacob Frankel, you've been on both sides of that.
Yeah, and I am extremely sympathetic because I've also, you know, represented a client who was, you know, who lost over $5 million in a securities fraud case that it always doesn't come out, and it was a very compelling case, and the result was not what was expected. And I think that's always the difficulty when you're dealing with local prosecutors. The other problem with local prosecutors, having also been an assistant district attorney in New Orleans, and I did, you know, what I'll call city level, municipal level white collar prosecutions, is that you have a lot of prosecutors who just don't want to do those cases. And I hate to say it, it's unfortunate that you as the victim become victimized twice. You become victimized when somebody steals the money, and you're victimized because neither the prosecutor will help and the judicial system, the proper process, including the availability of bankruptcy, works to their advantage. All I can suggest under those circumstances is to persist, because there really isn't a much better option. What I find when I'm trying to get a local prosecutor to bring a case is I try to bring them a case that is very neatly tied up, all the documents behind it showing them exactly how they're going to be able to prove their case and why it means something to the community for the local prosecutor to take an interest in the case. But unfortunately, you're absolutely right. It's often difficult to get local prosecutors to do these cases, and they really should be priorities.
Julie, were you
trying to... Everything lined up to show them the trail, what had happened, and everything. And they just kind of said, well, are you going to lose your home? Are you going to go bankrupt? And we said no. And they said, well, we just don't have the resources to pursue this. The sad thing is that she will turn around and do this to someone else.
And I think that's also very, very much part of your argument. And I think part of your pitch to them is to say, you know, this is somebody who has done it to us. You know, it's not appropriate to wait till there is a string of victims. And
right.
You know, all it takes is bringing one or two cases, because you, the prosecutor, will get it in the local media. The media will cover this case, and then people will see you take white-collar cases seriously. That's no different than on a major scale that you had a lot of people in corporate boardrooms who knew that, yes, the SEC would bring cases, but the fines would be small. There'd be civil injunctions, which really serve a mild punitive effect, but the Department of Justice isn't really going to take interest. And that's why DOJ, from a policy perspective, has made such a big deal about the perp walks, because now any corporate wrongdoer, I know we are talking at a much higher level,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinks that if that corporate person engages in wrongdoing, that person could then be paraded in handcuffs out of his or her office to the courthouse to stand trial, and there is a deterrent effect.
Julie, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's get, I think, one more caller in. Tom. Tom's with us from Destin, Florida.
Oh, well, the comment I had was sort of goes along with this last caller, is this the imbalance you have between the stuff that goes on that ought to be prosecuted and then the stuff that goes on and is prosecuted because of the political position of the particular defendant. Anytime anybody loses money in some big corporation going down or a deal, there's always somebody that wants somebody behind bars.
Pamela Busey, are people scapegoated like that?
Prosecutorial discretion in these cases is something that takes experience. Certainly there have been instances where in white-collar cases people were prosecuted who should not. There have been instances where people who should have been prosecuted were let go. So the exercise of prosecutorial discretion is very difficult in these cases, in part because the cases are hard to assess up front. They're just very resource-intensive.
And part of the reason that they're hard to assess is for the simple fact that for 25 years or so, we've been stuck in the middle of this so-called war on drugs, where all we have is a bunch of prosecutors and too often federal investigators who are waiting around for some snitch to tell them what went on, as opposed to getting into the documents, that particular industry, and really understanding what's going on. Having said that, when the federal government, not so much the state, but when the federal government decides to turn the FBI, the postal inspectors, all the various inspectors on somebody, you know, Cardinal Richelieu said a long time ago, give me six lines in the hand of anybody, and I will have enough to hang them.
Well,
when you look at the myriad laws that we have, and if some prosecutor decides this is going to make me a federal judge, this is going to make me a governor, okay, you can take an awful lot of stuff and make it look like somebody did something wrong when it in fact is normal activity. I had a case 3 months in trial. People were accused of extortion, and in essence, the charge came down to our defendants saying, you won't do business in this town unless we're part of your organization. Now, were they saying that because they were in fact...
Tom, I really don't want to get into the details of a case at this point. It's a little hard to litigate over the radio, but I appreciate the phone call and thank you for it. But I did want to ask, just to follow up on your point, Pamela Busey, do you know of cases where either prosecutors or judges have been able to take the notoriety that they got out of a white-collar criminal case and moved up to a higher political position?
I am sure that that has occurred, but there's the flip side to it. You lose one of these high-profile cases, and it can dash your career. So these are high-stake cases for everybody involved, for the defendants as well as the prosecutors, for the victims, just like the caller Julie indicated.
Yeah.
The stakes are very high for everybody. So I would not say that these are cases that people look for to advance their careers. They're just too risky in the courtroom for that.
Pamela Busey, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Pamela Busey, professor of law at the University of Alabama School of Law and author of White Collar Practice, joined us from the studios of Alabama Public Radio in Tuscaloosa. Also, our thanks to Jacob Frankel. Appreciate your time today.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Jacob Frankel is a defense attorney specializing in white collar crime and SEC matters at Shulman Rogers, Gandel, Porty, and Ecker, and he was with us from Rockville, Maryland.